from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you acknowledge an animal can be afflicted with mental illness, you've also got to recognize they have the capacity for complex emotions. And the science historian Laurel Breitman says that's often hard for humans to admit. Breitman says it's like recognizing an animal's capacity for language or tool use. It's a blow to the idea that we humans are truly unique. Breitman has spent years trying to understand what we know about mental illness in animals, traumatized elephants and compulsive apes and anxiety-ridden dogs, which describes her own dog, by the way. In fact, that's what got her thinking about all of this. Today in the program, she's joining us to explain what she learned. Her book is called Animal Madness. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some of you may have seen it in your pets, your dog maybe, or your cat, how the fireworks can really freak them out, or the vacuum cleaner, or maybe they have separation anxiety and they tear up the curtains or the duvet cover when you're at work. And this is not, of course, just domesticated animals. Apes and tigers and polar bears can have emotional disorders, which just tells us something we humans have had a difficult time admitting over the years, that we aren't the only creatures that have complex emotional lives. The science historian Laurel Breitman is our guest today. She's written a book about the mental health of animals, other animals, that is, besides humans, and what it tells us about our own mental health. It turns out other creatures need the same kinds of things we do to heal emotionally. They need therapy. Sometimes they need medicine. And they need empathy, too, love. The book is called Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Laurel Breitman is a science historian. As I said, she's a TED Fellow. She's written for Orion, The New Inquiry, among other publications. She's joining us today from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. And Laurel Breitman, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Well, your way into this story involves a Burmese mountain dog, Oliver, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I wanted to back up and ask about another creature in your life when you were a kid. You were 12, and you were put in charge of this Sardinian miniature donkey named Mac. And I wanted to start there because that's really how you begin in the book. And I guess this was your first real encounter with an animal who had mental illness, I guess.
Yes, he was absolutely charming and adorable. Sardinian miniature donkeys, when they're born, I mean, he was about 2 feet tall, not including his ears. He was a spectacularly adorable, fuzzy, tiny baby donkey. And his mother died right after giving birth to him. And I just fell in love with him immediately. My family, I grew up on a citrus ranch in Southern California. We had a lot of donkeys. And my parents allowed him to kind of be mine, provided that I would give him all the bottles he needed and take care of him completely.
Yeah. But and he was particularly, he was very charming at first, and then he could be a bit of a handful, I guess.
Yeah, that's putting it nicely. I mean, he really is kind of a jerk, but he's so captivating and wonderful. I mean, he stole my heart so early on, and I really feel guilty and responsible for a lot of his issues, actually, because a lot of them just stem from the fact that he was a creature raised between both worlds. You know, my parents were extremely indulgent because this donkey was so cute and I was so in love with him, and they really let him come into the house. He had free rein of the house. And I was in seventh grade, and I didn't know what I was doing. and I weaned him too early, and he went back into the corral with the other donkeys before he was ready, and he had no donkey mother to show him the ropes or to teach him good behavior. So he was misbehaving from the very start. And because he was kind of this odd donkey, the other donkeys didn't accept him. And yet he had been exiled from the house with the humans that he was close to. And so he really didn't fit in into donkey culture, and he also didn't fit into a human world. And 24 years later, he's still with us, actually. He's the sole surviving donkey at my family's place, and he may live into his 40s. And he's a little bit, you know, people call him a schizophrenic donkey. I don't think that's what's going on.
Right.
But he toggles between the poles of extremely sweet and extremely aggressive. He's actually quite dangerous.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about some of his impulses as we go, I guess. But you point out in the book that this is interesting that there isn't a branch of veterinary science dedicated to this question of whether animals can be mentally ill. I mean, there are a lot of animal behaviorists, of course. We get that. But the question of whether they can be mentally ill isn't a branch of veterinary science. That sounds surprising to me, and I wonder why you figure that is.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting thing. I think it's wrapped up in our fears of anthropomorphism or the projecting of human characteristics onto non-human animals or things. That said, you know, there's tacit evidence that people have acknowledged mental illness in other animals for a very, very long time. You know, one of the clearest places to look at that is in the psychopharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. So almost all of the drugs, one in five Americans is taking some sort of psychopharmaceutical right now, from the antidepressants to anti-anxiety meds to antipsychotics. And none of those drugs would be available to us had they not worked first in other animals. And they were tested in them not just for toxicity, but for behavioral effects. Mm-hmm. And it's actually our similarities, our neurophysiological similarities, that make those drugs useful for us. So that's one field that really is based on animal mental health. We just don't talk about it that way.
Mm. Why don't we?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the last 150 years, I think, has in a lot of ways been one long, slow scientific U-turn back to what Charles Darwin was saying in the late 19th century. He really believed other animals could, as he called it, go insane. He didn't think that they, quote unquote, went insane as often as humans, but he believed it could happen. And a lot of his peers felt the same. It really shouldn't be surprising to us then, 150 years later, that this is going on. But in the intervening more than a century, it became a rather sentimental idea that other animals could have a lot of the same feelings and emotions that we do. That said, you know, like the development of the psychopharmaceutical drugs in the 1950s really depended on these similarities between humans and other animals when it came to things like depression or anxiety and how to treat them. But we weren't talking about it that way. Thankfully, though, I think things are changing.
So it's almost like there's a cycle that you mentioned Darwin. He seemed to sort of change everything. But then if you go back a bit further to the 17th century, you write about this. Descartes, for example, had this idea that animals were just basically automatons, basically living machines.
Yes, yes. I mean, when it comes to how we make sense of non-human animals and their minds and their feelings, our history is anything but progressive. We have always toggled back and forth between thinking they're like us and thinking they're less like us. And actually, there's no even scientific consensus. So in the early 20th century, people like Ivan Pavlov were reading Freud, and then he was doing experiments on his own dogs to test the dog's response to trauma or to make a model of anxiety or nervousness in his dog. So even if other people may have been poo-pooing the idea of anxiety in canines at the same time, you know, Ivan Pavlov was busy just doing it in the lab. Also, the popular press has really never ignored this idea that other animals could, say, die of homesickness or mortal nostalgia. Pet owners, zookeepers, really anyone who's ever lived and worked closely with other animals, this is not news to them. And even if, you know, certain scientific communities have been waving it away, like the general public really, I don't think, was never not on board with this.
It's interesting. I wonder if we've really you say things are changing now, so I guess you sound a little hopeful that we're – but it seems like that This is a problem for the scientific community, or can be. Anthropomorphism, which you've talked about all, you know, in the past, you've talked about it as sort of it's time for us to do away with that as a taboo because it's limiting. And you say that we can anthropomorphize well and not so well. And there's a way to do it. Say a little bit more about that, if you would.
Sure. Life is full. In fact, all you have to do is like get on Facebook to look at instances of anthropomorphizing poorly. I mean, I think most of the internet is made up of like talking cats in outfits.
Right.
You know, and yet there's also something to all those internet forwards of like unlikely animal friendships. I don't know about you, but I get a ton of those, like
so
the hound dog who made friends with the orangutan or the parrot who's buddies with the cow.
Yeah. And
I used to laugh those off, you know, as being a kind of bad version of anthropomorphism and cutesy and staged. And I think the ones of like the snakes with the rats are definitely staged. That's just a, you know, a snake that had a rat for breakfast already and is digesting. But some of the others, particularly of social animals, there's actually something to that. And there's been some interesting research recently looking at oxytocin levels. It's a kind of bonding or love hormone that we release when breastfeeding or nuzzling someone we care about or after sex. And oxytocin levels seem to surge in humans and dogs after they spend time together when they like one another. And they also surged in other pairs of animals and much more unlikely pairs of animals, but who happen to be friends. So creatures like goats and dogs. So there's actually something to this, particularly in social animals. We tend to feel good being around other social animals. And, you know, in a lot of ways, that's pretty obvious. But it's one example of our kind of anthropomorphic view turning out to be correct. Another way is that if you live with a dog or a cat or a horse or and you believe that they're suffering from depression or they seem traumatized or they've developed a certain kind of phobia to, you know, beeping alarm clocks or billowing sheets on the line, you're probably right. So when we project, when we do a kind of informed projection onto creatures that we know well, I think that's a great kind of anthropomorphism. And we should embrace it because it helps us help them.
You know, it's interesting you write about I got one of those unlikely friendship videos just yesterday. There was this depressed goat and a donkey.
Oh, yes. Mr. G and Jelly Bean.
Yeah, did you see? Yeah, exactly. Which I actually want to come back to that a little later in the program because you have this whole section talking about this importance of companionship with animals and this idea the question that you say interests you most is how we make other animals feel better. And it seems like that's a big part of it. But it does get to the idea that you mentioned Darwin, who kind of really opened up this idea that animals, you know, he mentioned monkeys who express astonishment and chimps who can be contemptuous. And then you say in your book that there's this idea of love between animals and certainly between animals and humans, between dogs and humans. As you say, he had a relationship with his dogs. And I wanted you to say a little bit more about that because this is kind of a lovely part of your book. And you refer to the poet Mark Doty in a section early on where he says how being in love is our most common version of the unsayable, is how he put it, how loving an animal is what did he say? Resistant, I guess, to language.
Yes, and that maybe it's even more powerful because it's resistant to language. And I feel that way actually with a lot of my relationships with other humans, that in many ways the deepest expression of human affection is outside of language. And we share that with so many other creatures. Unfortunately, you know, the dark side of that is that when we lose someone close to us, oftentimes we can tumble into darkness and develop a mood disorder or just be sad for a while. And that I think that's true of most social animals. I saw cases of, you know, sad dolphins who'd lost either a person or another dolphin close to them or, you know, yes, the goat and donkey example of the goat who fell into a depression after he lost his donkey friend. And it makes sense. You know, this is the other side of the coin of an evolutionary behavior that's really good for us, you know, to bond with creatures that make us feel good, makes us healthier animals and better at being ourselves. The problem is that, mood disorders can, say, be the unfortunate side effect of being a feeling animal. And it turns out that most of us are feeling.
Yeah, who knew?
Yeah. Anyone who's ever had a dog.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Which is a perfect segue, of course, to Oliver. Let's talk about Oliver, because he really is, I guess he's the one that really got you thinking deeply about this question. How old is Oliver? Remind me when you adopt him. Four?
Yeah, he was I think between 3 and 4.
Right, right. And of course, you and your partner at the time adopt him, and he was fine for the first couple of months. But it was almost like a switch went off, and then he kind of went mad. Tell us about Oliver.
Sure. The first 6 months with him, yeah, were amazing. You know, we played hide and seek all over the house, and we would go on long walks, and we would sit around and pretend to talk for him, which is, like, I think the secret pleasure of dog companions everywhere. You know, that secret dog or cat voice you use when no one's around. Yeah. We all know what our animal's voice would sound like. You know, we did things like that. He was affectionate. He was easy to bring around. As far as I knew, he wasn't freaking out when he was left alone. And then about 6 months in, he developed just extreme separation anxiety. He would panic and destroy our house or himself anytime that he was left alone. He also started to suffer from hallucinations. He would snap at flies that didn't exist at night. He was diagnosed with a canine compulsive disorder because he would lick and lick and lick himself until he made wounds the size of, like, baseballs. He ate things that weren't food, like fabric or egg cartons with no eggs in them. He developed all kinds of problems. And what I realized sort of later, after I, you know, I was so naive when I went into this, and, you know, 7 years later, I can tell you I've talked to so many different experts about his behavior. And what I learned was this is actually quite common. And it's also interesting in some cases of people, particularly young children. Oftentimes, you know, we are on our good behavior for the first 6 months after we have a pretty big life change and we wind up with a new family. And then the kind of ironic downside of getting comfortable is that we begin to show our true colors, mm-hmm. and we stop masking, say, our anxiety. And I think that's what happened in my dog's case.
So one day you are away. You and Jude, your partner, are away in South Carolina. You have a neighbor taking care of Oliver, but he completely spazzes out one day and basically jumps. He chews the screen off of the window. Does he move the air conditioner out of the way? And he basically jumps out of a fourth floor or third floor apartment.
We lived
window.
On the third floor. But he fell 4 floors because he jumped out the window, but he didn't land in the yard. He landed in the stairwell of the basement apartment, which was like 1 floor below ground. It was about 55 feet, and he fell onto cement.
Yeah. And we should say he survived. I mean, it ultimately caused him problems that led to you having to put him down. But this is the thing, I guess, the point of this, of course, is that got you thinking. Because you took him, of course, and to see a veterinarian, a veterinary behaviorist, who suggested that you give Oliver Prozac and Valium. Now, what was the part of that story that got you really thinking deeper? Because in some ways, this is sort of the clincher story that got you writing this book in some ways.
Absolutely. You know, I'd grown up on a ranch. Our dogs were always, like, relatively well-adjusted. I mean, I never even had to use that phrase in response to dogs. I thought they were just dogs. I mean, I believe dogs had emotions.
Yeah.
But the idea that I would have to say whether my dog was anxious or not really never occurred to me. So when Oliver developed these issues, and yes, when he jumped out of our house, and he actually didn't break a single bone, and we went to pick him up at the vet clinic, and they said, you know, they wrote us a prescription, and then I asked what we could do, and they said, well, you can move to a first floor apartment. And I just was shocked. And I also wanted to know how these drugs wound up in the vet clinic in the first place, and also if they would work similarly in my dog than they were working for the many people that I knew on these drugs. And so that is what really launched me down this path. It was curiosity. I'd love to say that, you know, it was very selfless too, that I just wanted to know about animal emotional health, but it wasn't. You know, he was 120 pounds and he had already destroyed so much of our house by that point, and I was so worried about leaving him alone. So really the genesis of it was selfish. It was trying to help my own dog and also save my own peace of mind in whatever way possible. But very, very quickly, I went in trying to research this from Oliver, to elephants and gorillas and whales. It turns out that so many of us suffer from emotional thunderstorms that he really just cracked open my entire world.
It seems like when you talk about animals who have mental disabilities, anxiety or compulsive disorders, it seems like it's us, we humans, who screwed them up, you know, making them do hard labor like the elephants that you write about, or, you know, confining them to cages and zoos, or doing, you know, cruel medical experiments on them. But you say in the book that that's true, that we can screw them up for sure. But it's not just humans who are driving other animals crazy. They're also more than capable, you say, of doing it to themselves. Say something about that.
Oh, yes. I mean, actually, Oliver is a perfect example. He was not abused or mistreated. He was a rescue. We adopted him from another family, but he had not been mistreated. What had happened was that he was the center of this family's universe, and their teenage daughter had a baby, and he was displaced by this new pregnancy and then the infant. But they didn't abuse him. He just stopped getting as much attention. I mean, this is a really unfortunately common thing for a lot of dogs and cats, is when there's a new family member, you know, they sort of become very quickly third string. In another dog, this would have been fine. I mean, you know, it can't be an easy emotional experience, but not all animals would have come just kind of unhinged as Oliver did. But he did. So, you know, I think that's a perfect example. With dogs and cats, you know, we really, they're domestic creatures. They've evolved to live near us in a lot of ways. You know, we are their natural homes and their natural packs. And so, you know, certainly mistreatment or living in the wrong kind of environment or not getting enough exercise or all the things that can happen to them can affect their mental health for the worse. But that doesn't mean that they're going to wind up with a anxiety disorder and, canine OCD. That's just a mystery of Oliver's own personality and constitution.
Mm. Laurel Breitman is with us. Her book is called Animal Madness: How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. We invite you to join us with comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, or email address radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the science historian Laurel Breitman is with us. Breitman had a Burmese mountain dog named Oliver who was racked with anxiety and fears and compulsions, and it got her thinking about the mental health of animals, how all of that works, and what that tells us about our own mental health. We're talking about her book, which explains what she learned about emotionally disturbed animals. Turns out they can be healed, or at least treated, in the same way the rest of us can, with therapy and sometimes medicine, of course, sometimes empathy and love. The book is called Animal Madness: How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Can Help Us Understand Ourselves. Again, you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So you mentioned the part in the subtitle, how they can help us understand ourselves. What is that part? What did you learn about that part, the relationship of what we learn about our own selves by noticing these disorders in animals and other animals?
Oh, sure. Yeah, many, many different things. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, other animals have always stood in as mirrors and proxies for ourselves. So when we're trying to make sense of whether or not a certain behavior is normal or moral, for example, we often look to the animal kingdom to try and make sense of it. And then also very literally, we use them in the laboratory for understanding how we can better help ourselves recover from various things. And that's true in the case of, you know, all of the development of our psychopharmaceuticals. But it's also true in the context of things like behavior therapy. So behavior therapy for another animal, let's say you have a dog who's scared of thunderstorms, you know, like my dog was, oftentimes the behavior therapy for making them feel better is exposing them to bits and pieces of thunderstorms while making that experience pleasurable and kind of incrementally getting them more comfortable with the idea of thunderstorms as being pleasing. So whether that's feeding them treats right as the barometric pressure is starting to change, or comforting them and petting them and making sure that when the lightning is flashing that they know that you're right there. It's really kind of old idea, old advice that you should ignore a dog who's being fearful during a thunderstorm. They're much more intelligent and rational than to assume that if you're comforting them, then they should freak out. That's actually, I think, doing a disservice to canine mentality in a lot of ways. But that's actually how we also, in large part, help children and often adults to become more comfortable with something that triggers their fear or anxiety. And we practice a lot of that on other animals. Same with how we think of emotional, healthy emotional development in ourselves and other creatures. That stems a lot to Harry Harlow's experiences in the 60s and 70s, his research on monkeys in his lab, and doing things like showing that humans and other primates need a lot more than just being kept clean and given sufficient calories in order to thrive, that we need affection. Mm-hmm. And that really served to change how we think about institutionalized children, both in hospitals and orphanages. And that really changed the structure of the how we deal with institutionalized kids, and these kind of warehouses were replaced by the foster care system.
You mentioned identifying mental illness in other creatures. It helps us shed light on our own humanity, that our relationships with suffering animals, they make us, and this is how you put it in the book, they make us better versions of ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think some of the most sacred work we can do as humans is be therapy animals for each other and our pets often, you know. I definitely felt like a therapy animal for my own dog. And like I should have been the one, you know, wearing the service animal vest. And I saw this in so many other cases with so many other creatures. You know, sometimes the best service animal for an elephant is another elephant. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the best service animal for a parrot is a dog. Just a couple came out to a reading I did a few weeks ago, and they really wanted to tell me the story of their African gray parrot who'd been a big plucker. So she plucked out all of her feathers and when she was bored or anxious, and they were at their wit's end. They didn't know what was going to help her, and they ended up adopting two chihuahuas. And within weeks, she had stopped plucking her feathers. And they said they owe it all to these chihuahuas who don't really realize that they're therapy dogs, but they totally are. And so what this parrot does is she has a favorite wiffle ball toy. Okay. And she's so verbal, she learned the name of the chihuahuas. And so what she does is she stands on the edge of a table and she calls the chihuahuas over. And then so they come running and then they sit, and she sits on top of the table, and then she takes her wiffle ball and she drops it on their heads. And the wiffle ball then rolls away and the chihuahuas run away. And then she goes and gets the wiffle ball. She gets back up on the table, and then she calls them over again. And the humans say that she does this now all day, every day. And the chihuahuas never get it. You know, they always are like, someone's calling me. And then they run to the parrot. And the parrot is now so busy kind of tormenting these chihuahuas, who are not bothered, you know, but that she has no energy or time to pluck herself anymore. And so I think in this, you know, just like with a lot of humans, the answer is sometimes in just making ourselves more engaged in our environment, and busy, frankly, so that we don't have the time and energy to do things like hurt ourselves.
I want to ask you about what we know about, or what we're understanding anyway about the way other animal brains work anyway. You write about this neuroscientist, Jack Panksepp. From Washington State University. There's a great Radiolab bit where people may be familiar, where he tickles a rat, and which does a really great, and uses, I guess it's low frequency or high frequency, a detector, a bat detector is what it basically is, to hear these rats essentially playing. That's the guy. And you write a little bit about him, and he says that the emotional capacity evolved, he says, in mammals long before, and this is how you write it in the book, long before the emergence of the human neocortex and its powers of cognition. I wanted you to kind of explain a little bit about that, what we understand or what we know about that.
Sure. You know, we tend to think about emotional processes, at least in our own species, as being pretty evolved and complex. And I think that, you know, Panksepp and many other neuroscientists are arguing that that's not actually true, that our emotional experiences and the capacity for emotion is probably laid down much earlier, and that we share that with so much of the animal kingdom. And that's because emotions are so helpful. Mm-hmm. So particularly things like fear and anxiety and happiness. We usually feel fear and anxiety in a situation that's dangerous. And it's the feeling of fear that actually causes us to move away from whatever dangerous thing is. So it makes sense that that would have been really selected for and then preserved throughout the animal kingdom. And the same can be true for joy. You know, it feels good for a reason. Usually it's because we're eating something great or we're having fun or some strange bearded scientist is tickling us and we happen to enjoy it. These are great experiences that keep us doing healthy things. If you're a rat who likes to be tickled and the tickling, you know, feels good, it's a little bit of a loop of logic, you know, but it makes sense. And another thing Panksepp says, which I think is fascinating, is that other animals, certainly, and I think this is true as well, we don't want to say that rat joy is the same as human joy, mm-hmm. or that parrot depression is the same as human depression, for example. But it doesn't mean that they don't experience similar things. We just don't have the language for it. And so we have to use the language that's at hand. And in fact, they may have other emotions that we can't even guess at because they have other capacities. So, for example, I don't know what the octopus emotion is mm-hmm. for a sudden color change, right. or the bee emotion for seeing a particularly pleasing pattern in the UV spectrum. But that doesn't mean they don't have them. Or the elephant emotion for detecting a message from a long-lost friend through your feet using, you know, infrasound. That's an amazing thing. And likely other animal emotional worlds are even richer than ours, just in different ways.
There's a fascinating chapter about the use of pharmaceuticals, how they were developed for use on humans or animals first and then humans. But one of the things you write about early on, and I found this interesting, you talk about how most small animal doctoring, really until about the turn of the 20th century, that was the kind of the owners of pet shops. They're the ones who... if you had a problem with your pet, you'd go to these pet shops and they would give you these folk remedies, the same kinds of folk remedies that, you know, you got from other humans. Say a little bit about that. I think that's really interesting.
Sure. Yeah. It's pretty recent, actually, for us and for our animals that we have specialized physicians that treat emotional distress as opposed to, you know, a chest cold. Right. And before the early 20th century, yes, if you had a canary that seemed like they had a chest infection, you would often make a little rice gruel for your canary that was the same as the rice gruel you made for yourself, just in smaller portions. And you would go get a recipe book that would give you medical remedies that you would then cook up at home. Failing that, yes, you could go to the owner of a pet. You could go to a pet store or pet shop owner and they could help you out. And I think that's interesting. And, you know, in a lot of ways, that's what we're still doing now. It's just that the business is so much larger that many of our pharmaceuticals are branded differently, but they're still often the same thing. They're just in different packaging. And I wouldn't recommend taking, say, you know, your golden retriever's Xanax prescription for travel anxiety because their dosages are actually a lot higher. So you could really hurt yourself. In a lot of ways, you know, nothing is new under the sun. We've always been treating ourselves with the same things that we treat our animals with. It's just that what we're treating ourselves with has changed. And so therefore, you know, the arsenal of medications we use to treat our pets is changing too. And it's part of a huge and gigantic industry.
You read about the emergence of these drugs that could, you know, pacify humans and other animals as well. And this is kind of the emergence, I guess it's in the 1950s, of so-called tranquilizers. You write a good section about this and the relationship between the way we look at, we want to pacify animals and then pacify, this was the 50s, mind you, women is another really interesting part of this story.
Yeah, and prisoners. The idea of chemical straitjacketing that was discussed in the 60s and 70s, kind of retroactively looking at the dosing of people who had inconvenient opinions, for example, or inconvenient career goals. A frustrated woman who was at home, it was a little bit easier, to take a pill than it was to let her outside the home and start a career. In a lot of ways, chemical straitjacketing is alive and well in the context of other creatures. Even the division of the veterinary sciences that deals with this is called behavioral pharmacology, which is interesting. We don't call it behavioral pharmacology in humans, even though it's the exact same drugs. So built into the language of how we talk about it in other animals is this idea of behavioral control. So, I think that's interesting. That said, sometimes giving a creature a psychopharmaceutical is definitely the most compassionate option. One vet behaviorist I interviewed for the book, she said that if her patients were humans, a lot of them would already be admitted to inpatient psych wards. But because they're animals, there is no such thing. And so she has to have them on a pretty heavy drug regimen so that they don't hurt themselves. I think, though, that there are less ethical places where these drugs are being deployed, places like SeaWorld, for example, where the mother orcas are sometimes given anti-anxiety medications to cope after their calves are forcibly removed from them. Many animals in the United States and elsewhere have been in zoos, have been given psychopharmaceutical drugs to kind of ease their lives in captivity. I don't think that a creature should have to be medicated into being a good display animal. But sometimes they are really helpful when you can't change anything in a creature's environment, and they're otherwise going to hurt themselves. Then yes, giving a creature, a Valium or a Xanax is probably the kind thing to do.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. I guess it gets a little, it may be a little interesting on this book tour of yours when you are talking about this book or if you're on a program where people can call in. I'm guessing you get a lot of stories about their kind of crazy dog or kind of crazy cat or kind of crazy parrot. You must hear a lot of stories in these circumstances.
Yes, I do. But you know what? That's the best part of writing this book. I think sometimes, we write because we want to feel less alone. And that's really what happened to me, thank goodness. I realize that I'm one of so many thousands of people, probably more, who've fallen in love with a creature who just tests their limits and their patience and their bank account, but also causes them to reevaluate what they used to think. So I wish that I had come to this complex idea of other animal minds and emotional expression without having fallen in love with a dog who was deeply disturbed. But I don't think I would have, actually. Sometimes we really do have to fall in love in order to realize that what we were thinking before was a little bit limited.
Let's take a call before we get to another break. Tom is with us, joining us from Wendover, Utah. Tom, welcome.
I'm really kind of curious about if you have a different way, range of emotions you found from different species. It seems like the dogs that I've known are pretty much straightforward, but cats have a much more wide range and more subtle range of emotions.
That's spoken like a true cat owner, right, Laurel Preitman? I mean, don't you get that a lot, that dogs are just doo-doo-doo and cats are a lot more emotionally complex and aloof and all of those kinds of things? You want to comment about that?
Yeah, I often feel like this is a conversation like, men are from Mars and women are from Venus, sort of these massive generalizations that are actually seem to be based in something. So, yes, I really do think that various animals have their own emotional expressions, which we were talking about a little bit. Like, I don't even know. We don't have words, for example, for all of the elephant emotions. We obviously don't have words for cat emotions either. And it's possible that, cats as predators may even feel like, say, anger or aggression in ways that we don't understand. And they may feel those things more intensely. When it comes to abnormal behavior, oftentimes it manifests as a really normal, kind of common emotional experience or behavior in an animal gone too intense. So, for example, dolphins who become compulsive, it usually ends up as a kind of sexual compulsion often. And that's because dolphins are so sexual. Sometimes this stuff is pretty elemental. We may not have the language to describe it, but definitely they're having their own unique emotional experiences that probably have a lot to do with their species, but also individually. You know, one thing that this work really taught me was that we can't think about other animals at the species level. So, you know, one cat's emotional range is actually going to be different than another cat's emotional range, mm-hmm. just like it is in us. You know, we still don't have a list of the basic, quote unquote, human emotions. That's still something that's being fought about today.
You know, one of the things you mentioned, dolphins, one of the things that you've talked about before that really interested you is mental illness in the context of dolphins and whales. These, you know, these mass stranding incidents that you hear about that happen all of the time. What do you figure you understand about that? Because you do deal with this question of whether or not an animal has the capacity to commit suicide. Talk about that part, if you would.
Sure. Yeah. I got really interested in dolphins and whales because for centuries, people have likened their mass deaths to their strandings when they all come up on shore, when a large group of marine mammals will come up on shore and strand. And for a long time, people have been referring to those incidents as mass suicides. And I wanted to know if there was something to that. Many dolphins and whales have been proven to be self-aware, have a concept of self. They obviously show extremely complex problem-solving skills and are deeply intelligent. And so are they aware when they're coming up on shore that they are going to die? And if so, what does that choice mean? Oftentimes in these stranding incidents, only one or two individuals in a pod will have been ill. And I think that that is pointing to all kinds of things, you know, everything from naval testing to pollutants in the water. Mm. But also, I think it's pointing to a kind of cetacean social world and intentionality that we can't understand. And it may be that, you know, we're very used to thinking of ourselves as individuals with an individual consciousness. But when it comes to dolphins and whales who are stranding, it may be we are sick. We are going to die. Not, you know, my cousin Billy over there is ill. I'm going to go visit him and then I'm going to go back to the ocean. It may be that they're coming up because they don't have the option not to come up altogether. And that can be a form of self-destruction. And I do think we need to grant at least some other animals the capacity for suicide, because the way we think about suicide in humans is so complex. And people commit suicide in all different kinds of ways. Sometimes it's a, you know, premeditated action and a person is using a tool, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's an impulsive rash act mm-hmm. where someone is just choosing a state away from the state of pain that they're in without knowing for sure if the jump from the bridge mm-hmm. or the medication they're going to take is actually going to kill them. They're just desperate and panicking. And so they do what they do. And I think some animals definitely can do that. We can all hurt ourselves. We all engage in self-destructive behavior. It unfurls along a continuum and sometimes we die. And I think in that way, we do have something in common with other animals that self-destruct.
Laurel Breitman is with us. Her book is called Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Tom, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with science historian Laurel Breitman. We're talking about her book, Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Can Help Us Understand Ourselves. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Maureen is with us in Alpine, Utah. Maureen, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Really interesting discussion. My question for your guest is, I work with, my dog has become a therapy dog, and that's becoming more and more common. More places are using them. And one of the things that they teach us is to look out for what they call stress signals in our dogs. And actually, if they show the stress signals, that means they're alleviating the stress. One of them would be like shaking off or an inappropriate yawn. Like, you know, they're not tired, but they do a big, gigantic yawn. I'm wondering if we're really judging those stress signals appropriately, or is my dog just shaking off because he's been laying down for an hour? am I stressing my dog by bringing him any visits, mentally ill teenagers, adults, and geriatric patients? I know the teenagers adore him, but I always constantly wonder, am I doing right for him? Because he does get tired. Like, I know he takes on some of the emotional stress that he deals with. And so am I doing the right thing by bringing him into these places and sharing him and sharing what I love about him with those kids? And are those stress signals really stress signals?
You know, let me just broaden it a bit, because I think that one of the questions you get at, Laurel Brayman, is that relationship between humans and animals, and how human relationships can be crucial for animals. Elephants in particular, you write about a particular section on that as well. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely love that question. Also, good on you for taking your dog around to interact with so many different people, and also for trying to pay attention and understand your own dog's stress signals. And it is really, really complicated and really hard. And with time, just like it does in us, our stress signals can change. So I think the best thing that you can do is really understand your dog as best you can and make informed guesses. And when you think your dog is tired, to take your dog home, or when you think your dog is yawning too much and isn't tired, it's something to pay attention to, and those are good things to look for. But no one knows your dog better than you. So I really think that whatever you choose, actually, you sound like a deeply compassionate person who's actually really in touch with your dog. And the fact that you even call in with that question shows that your dog is in very good hands.
Right.
So I wouldn't be concerned. And on balance, I think therapy dogs in those situations do so much good. That seems to me always a very sad thing, that if you're a dog person and you end up institutionalized as an elderly person, for example, that you're so robbed of this like particularly like tactile, wonderful physical relationship. So it's great when dogs are brought into those places. And yes, actually, I really do think that emotional health is something that can be infectious, both for good or for bad. And yes, that is something that's really built into the human elephant relationships that I saw in Thailand, which is if someone was around a depressed elephant, what they would do when they were hiring for the person that was going to take care of that elephant, it was a very explicit part of the hiring process, was the personality of often the young man that was going to go work with that depressed elephant, and that he had to be cheerful.
Mm-hmm.
And then also that he had to be watched for signs of depression himself, that the elephant who was sad could affect the mental health of the man who was working with him. And I think that that's such a beautiful thing, and it's so practical in so many ways, particularly in Thailand, where you have 2,500 captive working elephants and thousands of men and just a handful of women whose day job is caring for them, that's part of how you get a job. Mm-hmm. Is matching your personality to the animal that you're working with. And that also you need to be careful that you don't want to catch depression, you know, from being around a sad creature.
Yeah.
Luckily, you know, that can really help us help each other, which is great. And I saw so many cases of that, you know, cheerful rabbits cheering up less than cheerful rabbits, or cheerful parrots who are helping a parrot who has a particular phobia or anxiety of being left alone, for example, that the animal kingdom is full of these cases of us helping each other through something hard.
There's a story you tell toward the end of the book of going to Baja, Mexico, with this wildlife biologist, a man by the name of Tony Frohoff, focuses on marine mammal behavior. And you have this experience that you write about. You describe it, in fact, as one of the most powerful and mystifying encounters of your life with this massive gray whale and her calf, which really gets at this sort of question about whether or not, and again, you said you sensed something, some kind of wonder, some sort of curiosity here. This was not just a basic kind of instinct. There was something powerful going on here, and I wanted you to tell that story here.
Sure, sure. So this took place in one of the calving lagoons off the Pacific coast of Baja. It's where the California gray whales go to mate and also have their calves in the winters. They travel down there from the Arctic and then go back in the late winter. And this place was actually one of the number one spots for whaling up until actually the 1950s. It was a huge seasonal congregation of gray whales. And so whalers could go there, and the mothers can be up to 70 feet long, and they're the real oil prizes. But what they would do would they would harpoon the calves because they knew that the mothers would rush to the aid of the calves, and that's when they could get the mothers. It was a really bloody, violent place. And then about 20 years after whaling ended, amazingly, it's also the only place in the entire migratory path of the gray whales where they chose to interact with humans in a friendly fashion. And so what they do there is they, and it's only about 10% of the whales in the lagoon, they call them ballenas amistosas, or friendly whales. And they come up to you, and they come up to tiny boats of people, and they want to make eye contact. One of the first things that the guides say, who are local fishermen who've spent decades with these whales, is to take off your sunglasses because the whales want to see your eyes. And it's true. And they come up, and all you do is, you know, you kind of put your hand in the water at the side of the boat and you splash it around, and the moms come up and they'll put their hand, their heads under your hands. Or what they'll do, and this is my favorite thing, is they'll take their babies, you know, and a month-old whale calf is about, you know, 20 feet long, longer than the boat you're in. And the moms put the babies on their heads, and then they kind of like push them up to see the humans, and the babies turn and spin and they open their mouths and they want you to put their hands in your hands in their mouths. And they want to make eye contact, and then they blow water all over you. And it's so clearly playful. They're not getting anything out of that interaction. They're not there eating. No one's feeding them. You know, I really think they're just learning about humans and boats, and we're something to interact with. And the rest of the day, they're just nursing. And so we're something to do. You know, you're kind of like a giant play toy for a toddler whale is how it feels. Right. And it's mystifying and it's magical. And it's so clearly some, you know, this is very anthropomorphic, but it's some clearly a kind of whale forgiveness. The biologist I first went down there with, Tony Frohoff, the first time she was there, the very first whale that came up under her hands had a harpoon scar. And that whale clearly remembered what it was like to be hunted by a person, and yet had survived and was now going up to interact with her just out of curiosity or wonder or affection or God knows what. It's a truly magical encounter.
Let me ask you this finally, about a minute left. You write about establishing what you call this lasting peace with this idea that we're just another kind of animal. Explain why that's important, because you say this changed, which you sense. It seems like you have a sort of an optimistic sense that it's changing, but it won't be fast, you say, and it won't be easy.
Yeah, I do think it's changing, though. You know, Darwin's most famous argument was that humans and other animals are not different in kind, but by degree. So that there is a continuum of animal life, and we are just located on one place on that continuum. And even though he suggested that more than a century ago, I think it's taken us quite a long time to get there, and we're not fully there. I think we've allowed certain other animals, you know, that we say live in our houses, onto that continuum, or that we think are cute. But we haven't quite made peace with allowing everybody else to be on that continuum too, and I think it's high time we did.
Laurel Brightman, science historian, the author of the book Animal Madness: How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Joined us from Studio KQED in San Francisco. Laurel Brightman, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was much fun.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.